Hi, hello. We have a jam-packed episode of the Dunker Spot coming your way. First, we salute the New York Knicks who have punched their ticket to the NBA Finals, first time since 99. We talk about how they got there, and we talk a little bit about the journey that the Cleveland Cavaliers were on and some questions they may have to answer this offseason. We then slide to the Western Conference Finals. We are tied at 2-2. Things we're going to be looking forward to ahead of this best of three. Can the Oklahoma City Thunder find their offense? Can the Spurs maintain their pressure? We talk about it. And then we shift to the W. We look at the middle of the standings. What's going on with the New York Liberty? Are they going to be okay? What's going on with the Portland Fire? Can they sustain this? What's happening in Seattle right now? We bounce around. We have a lot of fun. We hope you enjoy. Hi, hello, and welcome to another episode of The Dunker Spot. We are part of the Yahoo Sports Network. I am your host, Nikias Duncan. And joining me, as always, is my co-host, the always excellent Steve Jones Jr. Steve, happy Tuesday, sir. How are you?
Feeling good, feeling great. Happy to be here, excited to be here. Thank you, Dunkers, for once again embracing your bounce. Apparently, the concrete jungle is where dreams are made of, so it's time to hoop it up.
Wow. You know what? I'll ask you about that one post-pod. That's a funny one. All right. Fair enough. Anyway, we are fresh off of the Eastern Conference Finals ending, Steve. We got a 4-0 sweep in the Conference Finals. As you always say, the Conference Finals are a sweep, or not a sweep, but the Conference Finals are a sprint. And the New York Knicks certainly agreed. Over the weekend, a 121-108 victory in Game 3. And then last night, a 130-93 beatdown of the Cleveland Cavaliers. This is done. The Knicks get to kick their feet up a little bit before the final start in the middle of next week. So, Steve, just on a broad sense, how impressive was that New York Knicks series victory? What were some of your major takeaways?
I struggle to understand how you don't see this run from the New York Knicks and walk away impressed. I understand the thing where you say every team is not that great. Once a team achieves something, well, you didn't beat anyone good. Put that to the side. Nikias, you can count the amount of teams that have won 11 straight games in the playoffs on one hand. That is a thing that you can do. They are one of five. The 2017 Warriors won 15 in a row. The 1999 Spurs won 12 in a row. The 2001 Lakers and the 89 Lakers won 11 in a row. The New York Knicks are on that list. And I think for me, the most impressive part about this New York Knicks team and this New York Knicks run, they have solved problems quickly. And they have worked to deliver more of their own as the series goes on. Like, I think when we talk about this, a playoff series, and in the playoffs, it's not as much about how good your team is. It becomes key to this problem very quickly. The Knicks have done that time and time again. The closeout games are one thing. You know, they're the first team to win three closeout games by 30-plus points each in a single postseason in NBA history. They took these series before doing that. They got in their pickup truck, they rode to the arena and said, "I want your soul," and they took it each time. And I think there was a stretch to me in that closeout game early that just kind of spoke to the intention that the Knicks were playing with offensively, right? Jalen Brunson has looked to attack matchups this whole series. As the series has worn on, it's become like more mixed in throughout the game. But it was clear they wanted to go ahead and tap that early in this process. You had a play where Mikal Bridges screened for Jalen Brunson. That brought in Donovan Mitchell to the equation. The Cavs did not automatically switch it. They trapped it. Bridges slipped, missed a free throw line jumper. I was like, ooh, that's not a good sign if you're the Cleveland Cavaliers because you have blinked. The next time down, the Knicks have Josh Hart screen for Jalen Brunson because Donovan Mitchell, of course, come, let's hang out. The Cavs give the switch. Here's the thing. Karl-Anthony Towns is spaced on the left wing. OG Anunoby is in the right corner. How many Cleveland bigs are in the paint?
Zero.
So Mikal Bridges comes from the corner, fakes a back pick, slips, and scores. That's what they just do in these series as far as once we understand what your issue is, we're going to deliver that to you in multiple ways. And I think defensively, okay, we know you want to put Jalen Brunson in action. We know you want to put Karl-Anthony Towns in action. We're going to battle there. But we're going to mix in OG Anunoby on Jared Allen or Evan Mobley. And we're going to use that to take one of them off the board to a degree. So there's our early play in the elimination game. Like Cleveland goes empty side pick and roll with Donovan Mitchell and Jared Allen, only it's a switch, and Karl-Anthony Towns is around the dunker spot to help, and it's like, ooh, you have not unlocked that portion. They problem-solved They delivered problems. And I think for me personally, you tip the cap to Jalen Brunson. The Eastern Conference Finals MVP for a reason. When I think it's time to criticize Jalen Brunson throughout the course of the season, and you take your finger and you click and go to a tab and you talk about, oh, the defense, the efficiency, da 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 da. You have to remember what he's asked to do and how what he's asked to do is not an easy thing to do consistently. Hey, Jalen Brunson, go get us a bucket. Get enough of those buckets, you know, whether pull up, step back, drive, whatever. Do enough of that to where teams don't feel comfortable with how they wanted to guard you and they're going to double or send help. And keep winning as many matchups as you can, by the way, in the process. Continue to do so. And once they show that helper double, can you please just make the right reads? And then also hold up defensively. Like, the fact that Jalen Brunson was able to switch as much as he did in this series was so key. Sure, there were some short recovers. Some of them were wonky. Some went haywire. But he held up to a degree where it's like, all right, James Harden, I'll battle. Cool, Donovan Mitchell, we can go dance for a little bit. The secret sauce of a playoff series is not that your weakest link has to become a defensive stopper. They just have to do good enough to make the offense say, well, let's go somewhere else. That's the secret. You just have to hold up consistent, just enough to be like, this isn't the automatic you thought it was. Karl-Anthony Towns remained impactful on both ends of the floor, Nekias Duncan. And I think for me, with Kat, it's always been kind of he just has to elevate to do your job in pick and roll defense. Whatever your task is, nail your job. When we in drop, I'm drop back. I can turn that into a late switch. I got you. Don't worry about it. I can get to the level and I can drop back because I see you're fighting over. You don't need me. I'm out of here. Those kind of nuances are huge defensively. And it was not a perfect world. That game three, Cleveland was like, hey, Kat, would you like to guard? He was trying, but they were getting to him. The problem is that wasn't the ultimate solve. That didn't ultimately lead to them being like, oh, well, Kat has a trap because he did well enough to where, okay, we can live with this. We're scoring on the other end. Let's get better at this. Let's nail these edges. If my man is in the dunker spot, I might not get every block. I can get some contests in there. Offensively, I can space. I can win a drive. I can attack in a matchup. I can get a post up. We can play through me. We can get some movement going. We don't have to do any of these things, but just know it's there. That's the Karl-Anthony Towns that we've seen in this playoff run. And by the way, while you're dealing with Jalen Brunson and Karl-Anthony Towns, trying to put them in a box, here's Mikal Bridges, who shot, 27 for 38 over the first three games of the Eastern Conference Finals? Here's OG Anunoby, who wasn't as loud as in the Atlanta series, but hey, you need a timely basket? I got you. Don't worry about it. And then, Nekias, you think about the Knicks bench, right? And I think, you know, we'll talk about OKC later, but there's a movement and a thought process to expand your rotation throughout the playoffs, to be able to call on different guys in different scenarios, different situations. Do we give the Knicks enough credit for what these guys have done coming off the bench? I remember how New York Knicks fans felt when they saw Deuce McBride guarding CJ McCollum in that Hawks series. It's in my brain. It's burned in here. Think about the fact that he has still helped. He was huge in that Sixers series. A little more muted in the conference finals, but still impactful. Think about Landry Shamet, his growth defensively throughout the season. He didn't get his number called as often as you would think, but he was ready when it came. Nekias, Earl Grey, Duncan, did you know Landry Shamet shot 91.7% from three in the Eastern Conference Finals?
11 or 12, got it in the notes.
You can take your volume 91%. That's an English exam. That's not what you're supposed to do. Mitchell Robinson, do what you do in these minutes. And also, by the way, Hack a Mitch bonus. Good luck. Did you have fun? We did what we had to do. Lastly, think about Mike Brown. Think about Mike Brown. Take a second. Walk with me. What was it, May, early June 2024, 2 years ago, he signs that extension with the Sacramento Kings. December 2024, he's let go by the Sacramento Kings. May 2026, he's taking the New York Knicks to the NBA Finals for the first time since you were, what were you, like 6 or 7 years old?
That's a good bit. No. 99 would have been like 4 going on 5. It's been a it's been a while. It has been a while, brother.
So yeah, I you tip the cap to the Knicks. I you got to give them their credit. You the journey that they went on to see them go through the regular season and have to figure out things offensively, defensively. This is not a perfect year for the Knicks. They got dinged defensively. Their mm-hmm. offense had to evolve in different ways to where, okay, are we getting on enough off-ball movement? Are we just doing what Mike Brown would like us to do? Are we getting pick and roll? Are we getting everyone in the right setup? To see them go through that and then flourish in the playoffs is where you should find the joy.
Mm-hmm. I think for me, I don't even know where I want to start. Like, I think there is just a baseline level of I am super impressed by this Knicks run. So I guess starting from the very beginning, you already mentioned the win streak. 11 wins in a row, 10 of them have been by double digits. The only single-digit win for the New York Knicks during this win streak was game 2 of the Sixers game, which means a game against the Cleveland Cavaliers in which they were down by as many as 22 points ended up being a double-digit win for them. Like, that is just not how, at all how that's supposed to work. I was looking at some cleaning the glass stuff earlier this morning. So entering the NBA Finals, the New York Knicks, so it removes garbage time, they have a net rating of 21.9. Heading into the finals, only 7 other teams have had a postseason run with a net rating over 10. That is the 2010 Orlando Magic that eventually lost to the Lakers in the final. They eventually lost. The 2014 Spurs won the title. The 2016 Cavs won the title. The 2016 Spurs, who lost earlier in that postseason. The 17 Warriors, which is like the current high since the database goes back to 2003-2004, they had a plus 16 net rating throughout that 2017 postseason run, which is absurd. The 28 Warriors did it, and then last year's Cavs did it before they eventually lost to the Indiana Pacers. So you could thank the Heat series for that one, but I'm not going to go on my soapbox on that one. And so, like, the Knicks just being plus 23, plus 22, including this insane win streak, is nuts. That's not what it's supposed to look like, Steve. And, like, I was thinking back to all of the conversations with Knicks throughout the regular season. The highs, the weird stretches. Like, I know I was very loud on the, hey, so I see the potential here. The Knicks were a preseason finals pick for me. This defense looks good earlier in the year. It slipped a little bit. This offense is looking really good. And then it's, hey, what's going on with this Brunson and Cat stuff? And I'm just like, hey, can they bottle this enough? We have seen the good stretches on both ends of the floor. Can they find this at the same time? And that was largely what the end of the regular season was for them. They hit some stumbling blocks early in that Hawks series. And then it's just been this. And so I echo your sentiments that it has been really cool just as a basketball fan and a basketball analyst to see the Knicks find these answers and to have the problem solved to the degree that they have been. And I think just looking at the individual Knicks, I'm probably most happiest for Cat throughout all of this.
Mm.
Just for what he has had to endure on and off the court, even beyond just the Knicks tenure. Like, this is just a guy that has been through a lot. And to hear him like recently talk about like the growth that he's seen from the locker room, the way that he's been accepted in the Knicks locker room, him being able to lean more on the leadership portion because they accept him more. And it's just like, that's also that we don't talk enough about that part and that kind of like internal growth or off court growth. But like, that makes me happy to kind of see that progress. In addition to on the court, we were having conversations on the pod. Like, hey, how many elbow touches is Cat getting? How often is he used in pick and roll? What does the defense look like? For that to turn into Cat as the hub for most of this postseason run and what he unlocks with Jalen Brunson off ball. Cat knocking down shots. Cat getting to the drives. Cat defensively, who has defended more pick and rolls than anyone in this postseason run, and opponents have generated a little over 0.8 points per possession on any trip featuring a pick and roll defended by Cat. That is an elite DPOY level number for Karl Anthony Towns. Now, again, you watch these games, it is Cat doing his job, and it's also Mikal Bridges navigation, Landry Shamet navigation, OG Anunoby off ball, et cetera. Like, it is a team effort. But as you already hit on, a lot of this is Cat just doing his job. And so for him to kind of find this sweet spot on both ends, and if it leads to this finals appearance, like, I am just happy for him just as a person. And obviously the play has been very good as well. So, like, that part has made me happy. Jalen Brunson winning Eastern Conference Finals MVP, and he shot 18% from three in the series, just kind of speaks to how good he was overall. And I'm glad you touched on the defense in particular, because the Cavs just could not poke at him to the degree that they wanted him to. And like his effort when switching or when showing and recovering, even if it wasn't perfect, you just kind of felt like this is a guy that wants to do the right thing. This is a guy that if you beat him, it is because you were better, not because he just didn't feel like playing defense. And like you just kind of need that baseline level of effort. And it's easier for everyone else to buy in defensively if your star player is buying in. And if your star player is attempting to be picked on and he's still holding up and giving that effort and taking charges, forcing some turnovers, getting some deflections as well. It's just like, okay, well, if he's doing all this, I have even more reason to help him out and do my job. And it's just kind of led to this team why I think it is really cool. And the last thing I'll say, Knicks fans have been going through it for a very long time. And to see the reaction on my personal timeline, to see the various video cutouts, they once again made that Cavs game a home game. Happy for them, frankly. It's been a long time since they've been in the finals, and I know the finals atmosphere in game three, game four, whatever else, is going to be insane in New York. So I wanted to give the quick salute there as well. But this has just been a super impressive playoff run for the New York Knicks. And I'm excited to see what they look like against either the Spurs or the Thunder once we get there. It's been wild.
There was a very fascinating through line where like Knicks fans were rightfully puffing their chests out. I understand it. You haven't seen this. There are whole grown people who have never seen the Knicks get to the finals. So, hey, I understand. But at the same time, I remember what y'all was saying when CJ McCollum was getting those buckets. Y'all, that 2-1 deal, y'all were not pleased. I just know I know, but I'm happy for you. I'm happy for you. Get that chopped cheese on me. Don't worry about it. I think the biggest thing you think about is that the journey is not easy. And I think when you look at the Eastern Conference in particular, I found it wild. I was just scrolling, going through a rabbit hole when the blowout was happening. I was like, hey, this feels like things have happened. And so if you think about it, Nikias, if you go back to 2022, right? Mm-hmm. Boston beats Miami in the Eastern Conference Finals, right?
Mm-hmm.
You go to 2023, Miami beats Boston in the Eastern Conference Finals. You go to 2024, mm-hmm. Boston beats Indiana in the Conference Finals. You go to 2025, Indiana beats New York in the Conference Finals. And you go to 2026, and New York beats Cleveland in the Conference Finals. Now, do I think this is like an automatic that means Cleveland's going to go to the Conference Finals next year? No, I don't think that's a pattern. But I think this should the pattern exists, and it should remind you the journey is the journey, and it's hard to skip steps. And so as you pivot towards the Cleveland portion, let me tell you, from personal experience, losing in the conference finals, extremely down bad feeling. Horrendous vibes. Doesn't feel great. You have put yourself in position to be 4 wins away from having a chance to compete for a title and fulfill your goals, and you fall short there, and it's like everything vanishes. Over. Night-night. Think about this with Cleveland, right?
Mm-hmm.
We peel the curtain back. Guys, we're recording early on the 26th. 9 days ago, Nikias, the Cleveland Cavaliers went on the road and won game 7 against the number 1 seed on the road again by 31 points.
Mm-hmm.
7 days ago. Seven. The Cavaliers are in Madison Square Garden up 20 against the Knicks. They lose that game in overtime. 6 days later, their season is over. Lights out. Done. Kaput. Capiche. The conference finals are a sprint, Nikias. And I don't mean that just because the games are every other day. It's a different type of series, and you have to come out swinging because the punches you land, they hit harder. The punches you receive, they hit harder. You're facing a team that with each win can taste the NBA Finals. Not oh, we're going for it. Finals are a bust. No. It's on our doorstep. This isn't home court advantage. This isn't taking control of the series. This isn't pivotal. No. Our goal was to make the NBA Finals. It's right there. You are now facing a team with a different level of buy-in, a different level of activity, a different level of effort because they can see it. Mm-hmm. And so I think for me, when it comes to Cleveland, as we pivot, they never really delivered the right combination in this series. And that's the hardest thing to swallow in the conference finals, because you know who you are. You know exactly who you're facing. You know exactly what you have to do. And you fall short in that moment. And all you can do is take it. Mm-hmm. There's nothing else you can do. Especially because, again, conference finals losers get the same soundtrack. A couple different beats in different places. They're like, oh, you did all this for that? Okay. Think about Minnesota, right? They made back-to-back conference finals, and then they lost, and it's like, oh, it's over. Like, there's a theme that comes with losing in the conference finals. It's the hardest, toughest thing to swallow in the world. The Knicks would not budge. They did not give Cleveland a lot of different avenues on either end of the floor, as we've talked about over the course of this series. And if you think about just purely the series, game two, the Cavs had 31 made field goals, 15 assists. Game three, the Cavs had 42 made field goals, 22 assists. Game four, they had 32 made field goals, 21 assists. Mikhaïs, they made 16 threes in game one, right?
Mm-hmm.
They made 32 threes the rest of the series. They shot 32% or worse in each game this series from three. They shot sub 30% from three in the last three games. Think about how cruel the game of basketball is. They beat Toronto and Detroit, who you got a microphone, you're talking to it, and you talk about those teams. Well, they can't shoot. They can't win. Ah, ha, 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 ha. And then Cleveland gets to the conference finals and absorbs that. And they can't make a three. They just never had a consistent thing that forced the Knicks' hand. They weren't able to make Cat a potential problem, weren't able to get foul trouble game, weren't able to poke at Jalen Brunson, and then defensively they just didn't have enough to make the Knicks kind of be this different team to a degree. The Knicks, you know, the Knicks had to guard drives. They had to help them recover. The theory was Cleveland could have an offense that gets the Knicks in rotation. They have to deal with that. Never fully landed that plane, especially after what happened in game one. And so I think for me, I credit Cleveland for having a heck of a year. I understand that the entire world is going to go to the top rope and drop an elbow on them.
Mm-hmm.
Hands up, can't control nothing. But the journey is the journey. You can't skip steps. And a lot of times when it comes to trying to win a championship, you are going to fall short. The list of teams that have made the conference finals, it's different. Like, how many conference finals has Memphis made, guys? By chance. Trivia question. Real quick one.
Oh, dear. Well, was it literally one?
Yeah. I worked there when they did it. This should tell you exactly how hard it is to do this.
Yes, that is a tough one. I'd say, like, on the Cleveland front, and we were joking about this before we started recording, I was like, you know, I'm glad I kind of have my thoughts together on Cleveland, because I was watching that game four and I tweeted it. I'm just like, you know, I'm gonna give the Knicks my love on the pod right now. I'm just like, Cleveland, what is this? What is happening right now? Like, losing is one thing. The consistent, like, transition runouts the Knicks were able to give, it's like, hey, it just can't look like this. It just cannot be this. But you zoom out, this is their first Eastern Conference Finals appearance since, what, 2018 for the Cleveland Cavaliers? Like, they made the James Harden-Darius Garland swap. And for large portions of this postseason run, James Harden was arguably their best player throughout the postseason. Now, we get to this series. That was not the case. We will just put it that way out of the interest of time. But, like, you make that kind of win-now trade, you go further in the playoffs than you did last year. And Kenny Atkinson talked about it a little bit post-game, where it's like, yeah, we made steps. The series didn't go the way we want to. We didn't make enough shots, et cetera. But, like, they did improve from the year before in terms of how far they went. And so I am curious to see, like, how they absorbed not just the conference finals loss, because Steve already laid out how tough those losses are in particular, but, like, what lessons they learn and how they go about retooling this thing if they decide to retool this thing. So that part is going to be interesting to me. But to your point, Steve, it is kind of cruel to go from we're battling with Toronto, we get it done. We have Detroit, we ultimately get it done on the road in game seven. We have a chance to immediately steal home court, and they blow it at the end of that game one. They blow it slash the Knicks take it from them. So let's give the Knicks their credit as well. And then they just never recover from that. And like when we talked on Friday through the first two games, I was like, I feel like Cleveland has a Jalen Brunson problem. And I was more so thinking about the defensive end for Cleveland, to where can we switch against him? Can we drop against him? Can we get the preferred matchups on him because of the way the Knicks are moving Jalen Brunson around the board? It was kind of problematic for them through the first two games. But I think, to your point, Steve, that also works on the defensive end as well. Like, they could never poke at him consistently. They did different things to try to get him in action. It was just like regular pick and roll to see if we can get a switch. Let's go double drag with his guy as the first screener so we can force that switch and play out of that. Like, they tried. And they dinged him at points, but they never got to the point where New York felt like, okay, we have to do something different. We have to ramp up the aggression that further opens up the rotations for us. And you mentioned the three-point shooting already. I had also had this in my notes. 5 of 28 from three for James Harden. 8 of 25 from three from Max Strus. 6 of 21 from three from Sam Merrill and Evan Mobley. And a lot of the Mobley attempts were just wide open because New York was fine with conceding those. Dean Wade went 4 of 10 from three. But like 10 attempts through four games, that isn't going to do enough to like bend what the Knicks want to do. And so you just could, and we talked about it on Friday, like there was a level of like lineup searching that Kenny Atkinson was doing to try to find the balance of two-way aptitude within these five-man groupings. He just couldn't get to. And like some of that is, you know, the coaches have to own some of that. You didn't press the right buttons. But a lot of this is just the Knicks put so much pressure on Cleveland on both ends of the floor. They executed so well. And then you get to like game three and game four in particular, and just felt like there was a steady uptick of the Knicks saying, not only do we have some answers in the half court, what if we just push after every made shot? And let's just get the ball up as quickly as we can. And so now, even as you're trying to navigate what we're doing in the half court, now we got to contain the ball before we even get to that part. And like it popped very early in that game four in particular, where it's just like, okay, y'all aren't even giving yourselves a chance to slow down New York right now. If you're having this kind of thing, one of the things I was looking at on Clean the Glass, Steve, and I toss it back to you, was just how often the Knicks were able to turn missed shots into transition opportunities, independent of like if they scored or not. Just how often were they able to turn this into transition stuff? And to see it skyrocket game by game by game by game, and you got to the point you get to the game four, it was like 36% of those missed shots turned into transition opportunities. So like a fourth percentile mark across postseason. Like, it just became untenable. We don't have half-court answers, and now we can barely get you in the half-court because we're running. It just got tough for Cleveland. So, again, it's a hat tip to the New York Knicks. And you got a long offseason ahead for the Cleveland Cavaliers in terms of the contract decisions and things they want to do on that front. But that's all I had. I was going to be nice. I got my frustration out yesterday, so...
Where you got your frustration out? I was not aware. Well, good for you. I would just say, are you ready for game five of the analytics conference finals?
Oh, that's one of those things where, like, I understand why people were like annoyed by that. Kenny Atkinson has been a process person for a very long time. If you go back to some of the Nets quotes and things, like, this is just how he thinks about things. We want to play the right way, generate good shots, and the results will lie where they lie. And so I get the frustration with hearing that stuff when you were down in the series. But like, you zoom out, he didn't really say anything ridiculous, at least not to me. But you know, it just kind of is what it is. It's got to hold that.
I'm so sorry to guys. I know you love the process and the numbers and the tabs. You can't be down 3-0 and say, well, this says we should be up. Because that's not what happened.
It's not what happened. But like, I think you could understand what he was saying. It's like, we are generating shots. We have to make our shots. Like, as we both kind of alluded to, they did not make those. So like, no, the process in a literal sense is not more important than actually winning the game. Like, I don't think anybody would argue that point. But for me, my thing is just more, you understand what he is saying. It's kind of my thing. Like, we don't have to be disingenuous about what he was saying. That's all.
No, because here's the thing. They weren't generating the shots they needed to. That's the interesting part.
It's not a part.
That's the real dynamic no one wants to talk about. They weren't able to generate those shots, despite it looking great. As far as the shot quality, to a degree, that they weren't consistently generating those. So the last bad. Where are you finding buckets? Or are you getting buckets? What are you doing? You know what I mean?
That's a bar. That's a bar. That is fair.
I do what I do. Last question before we get out of here. Mm-hmm. So how do you feel about Evan Mobley after this series, bud?
Like, pretty solid overall. I do think you saw, particularly with some of the drives, like there is just still growth needed there. I already mentioned the 3-point numbers. Like that is always just going to kind of be a bonus to the Evan Mobley portion. What is most important for him is like, how often do you win on drives when you do get random post opportunities? How often are you winning on those? And when you are the only big on the floor, how often are you helping the team clean the glass? And so like, I think there is like obvious growth areas within all three of those sections for him, but he is still a very good basketball player. So like, I haven't moved off of that part. For me, and it kind of goes more into an offseason deal, I'm more curious, like, how does Cleveland feel about Evan Mobley? And, like, where do they see him kind of peaking in the hierarchy for their team? And, like, does that open up any of, like, the Giannis stuff or whatever that may be floating around there in terms of big swings that they could potentially be in conversations with? But, like, I would have liked for Evan Mobley to be more consistently impactful, but, like, I don't overall feel bad about it.
Understood. Well, I've received a message. We have to windmill gather our thoughts. We are going to take a break. Stick with us here on the Dunker Spot. We'll be right back.
And we are back with this episode of the Dunker Spot as we shift to the Western Conference Finals. Steve, that series is still going. We are tied at 2 games apiece since we last recorded. A 123-108 victory for the Oklahoma City Thunder. Big Jarrett McCain minutes. Big Isaiah Hartenstein game again. Shai Gilgeous-Alexander perked up. And then we had game four, Steve. San Antonio Spurs, 103-82, in which their defense was very, very, very rude to the Thunder. But just to toss it to you, Steve, what kind of stood out to you across these two games? What are you kind of looking forward to heading into tonight's action?
Well, I mean, I just think to me, this Western Conference Finals has been an unbelievable back and forth series between the Spurs and the Thunder. It's best out of three. And so, like, we're recording Tuesday. We can peel the curtain back. Game five tonight, game six Thursday. We're either going to talk about how this was won or we're going to talk about a game seven. And both of those things feel like extremely likely possibilities. If you look at game one, if that was a message from the Spurs, and if game two was a reminder from the Thunder, game three was a message from the Thunder, and game four was a reminder from the Spurs. Mm-hmm. It's all dust right now. And so I think the contrast between game three and game four was insane, because if you go back, you remember that unreal start from San Antonio in game three and the unbelievable response from OKC. You had the combination of the Oklahoma City bench continuing to hit shots and Shai playing at a high level, and that flipped the Spurs defense. Like, ooh, can you sustain that? And then Oklahoma City was just working and say, hey, Wimby, it's very cool that you're out here. We're going to move you around. And when Shai plays at a high enough level with his shot making that does not care about the scheme and his ability to continue to make plays when he reads the doubles, it forced a different kind of help, a little bit of an overhelp. So in my notes, Nikias, I had in game three, the Spurs are overhelping and Wimby has to be more aggressive on offense. Assertive was probably the right word. And I think the one thing I'll say is he did that in game four. I thought Victor Wembanyama set the tone offensively. It was not a perfect world. I would not call it dominant. But there were so many of these, hey, Oklahoma City, you have to deal with me looking to score type of plays. The lobs, throwing the ball at the rim and trying to get a rebound or get a second jump. I'm actually going to try and cook one-on-one. I'm going to take a pull-up three. I'm going to take a pull-up two. I'm going to swing it after I did two dribble moves. That's so important for San Antonio, for him to just say, hey, just know, like, this is not a passive deal for me. Mm-hmm. And so that's something I'm looking to go on. The other thing in that game four that really stood out to me, the San Antonio Spurs dialing back the help on Shai Gilgeous-Alexander while still delivering the help. Game three felt very overhelpish, where, okay, you're scoring, absolutely not, but that opened up so many different types of three-point shots, so many different types of cuts for Oklahoma City. It made their offense easier. In that game four, yeah, when you drive, we are going to collapse. We're going to show early help, but we're not going to commit to the same level. And so I think it gets interesting dynamically, because I think for San Antonio, to win this series, they have to win a game where Shai plays well and their defense still sustains, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's back in my brain. I think for them to win this series, they have to win one of those. It's obviously easier if you make Shai not play well or you contain the bench and they don't have historic production. But I think if they want to swing this out of the park, they want to knock it out of the fence, They have to have a game where Shea is doing what Shea does. We still survive. We still sustain. If I'm Oklahoma City, I know that Shea can make these kind of plays. He can make these kind of baskets. We trust our team. We expand our rotation. All we have to do is get to a point where Shea makes them think. Everyone makes plays. We defend at a high level. We take this. So how far off am I as we go to the best of three, Nikias?
Oh, no, I don't think you're far off at all, Steve. I love everything that you said there. I think very quickly, if we're getting into like the more fun basketball things, like welcome back, De'Aaron Fox. Dylan Harper, glad you're okay. Oh, no, Jalen Williams, we still haven't seen you. Oh, no, A.J. Mitchell, who suffered the injury towards the end of game three, didn't play in game four. And so all of that kind of looms as we head into the game five later tonight and however long the series extends past that. So let's get that out of the way first. The thing I most wanted to bounce off of from what you said there was the Spurs defense, because that felt like the story and the major theme for me across these two games this weekend, to where they were super aggressive. They got out to that 15-0 start in that game three, but like super aggressive, but OKC was able to find some answers. You get the timely plays and shot making and shot taking from Jarrett McCain and others, and they bounce off of that. And then game four is just like, okay, so here's what we're going to do. We are going to continue to pick up Shea high up the floor when he brings the ball up the floor. We're going to pester that handle. When OKC moves him off the ball and they want to get into Chicago action or whatever else, we're still going to be handsy and physical with him. We're going to deny him off the ball, make it difficult for him to catch the ball. In pick and roll, we'll have Wimby up a little bit higher, but it's not going to be like the pure at the level or some head stuff that we saw in some of those wing pick and rolls in game three. Let's dial that back a little bit. And we're not going to sprinkle in the volume of just the random half court traps that we've seen early in the series. And so, as you said, Steve, being able to keep pressure on Shea without feeding him those same types of automatics, I think made a big difference in that game four in particular. And I was looking at some of the Shea numbers from game three to game four and just seeing like where he was in terms of what OKC generated offensively on possessions where Shea touched the ball. Went from 1.13 in game three to 0.73 in game four. That is not tenable for them. Dribbles per touch, as we talked about on Friday, where it felt like Shea was attacking a little bit quicker, you know, internal clock sped up, et cetera. Went from 5.7 dribbles per touch in game three up to 6.5. That's a lot of extra work that Shea's having to do. Obviously, he's the MVP, so he's good. But all that on-ball pressure, all that off-ball physicality, and then he has to work harder to generate the shots, that kind of has an effect. You look at what OKC generated on Shea drives. Went from 1.2 in game three to like a flat one in game four. Fine, but not elite, what we're used to with Shea. In pick and rolls, went from 1.35, which again, San Antonio mixing in some of the at the level or higher stuff against him. We dialed that back down to 0.9 in that game four. That, I don't know how sustainable that kind of dip is. And for OKC, it just cannot be if they want to win game five and ultimately win this series. But San Antonio dialing it back to that degree while still keeping pressure on and having OKC in that kind of box, it was very loud in the game four. And you saw with the Shea drives in particular, I think it was only four turnovers for him, only. But, like, it feels loud when it goes from one turnover in that game three to four in that game four. And you saw just some of the drives. It's like, okay, I'm not winning as cleanly as I once was. And then once I approach the free throw line area, that's when these late digs are happening. If I pick up my dribble, then it's turning into, like, just an actual double team to force the ball out of my hands late in the clock. It was San Antonio just felt so much more timely when they did want to ramp it up. And I think that bothered Shea. And as him being the head of the stake, that then puts the hourglass or puts, you know, shines the light on everyone else, where it's like, oh, that's something that you talked about a lot, Steve. You have these Shea touches, but you have Jalen Williams one pass away. Oh, they don't have Jalen Williams. Who's going to be the guy that can take some pressure off of Shea for a few possessions? We didn't have Alex Caruso losing his mind offensively in this game. We didn't have Jarrett McCain losing his mind offensively in this game. There were so many Cason Wallace drives where, like, okay, cool, scrambling defense, I am attacking. That is Victor Wembanyama. It's like the Friday scene. You want some of this too? Nope. Gets out of there. And it's like, okay, what exactly are we getting into now? And so not only was Shea not comfortable, you didn't even get the same like 3-point variance that you were getting early in the series where OKC, where San Antonio was like, we will concede these shots to theoretical bad shooters. They were more intentional about saying, no, you actually have to drive in this game. And so you just lost everything in terms of like the automatics that we saw earlier in the series. And so for OKC, you have to find a way to get some of this back on the table. Like, I imagine, like, do we see more of the flat spacing alignment for them to clear some of these wings for Shea? Like, there are some low-hanging fruit adjustments to make things easier. But San Antonio, I think you nailed it perfectly, Steve. Like, it was very much a reminder in game four. Like, hey, we, unlike any other team in the league, can put you in a box offensively that you have not been in. And you have to work really hard, both physically and also just schematically and structurally, to get out of that box against us. And so that's where you zoom out. This series has just been a lot of fun to watch and to analyze. But San Antonio deserves a lot of credit for putting OKC back in that box while keeping that pressure on.
I mean, I think both teams deserve credit for what they've done in this series. Because if you think about what San Antonio did in game four, it had to be a direct response to what Oklahoma City did in game three. As far as that's cool that you have this help. It's cool you're able to have Wembanyama in different positions and hurt our cutters. And okay, the physicality that the Oklahoma City Thunder had to deal with in game four was interesting. Mm-hmm. And I think it's fascinating because of what San Antonio did at the start of game three. Now, OKC was able to respond to that quickly. But the battleground feels like San Antonio finding enough of a baseline offensively. And that's why what Wembanyama did was important to provide a little bit of stability. But now, okay, when they can get stops defensively, they can now flow offensively. Not just the easy ones to transition. We just get you on your heels. We don't have to face a set half-court defense. That's so important for San Antonio, especially in the series, because Oklahoma City is a very good defensive team. I think like that gets lost in the wind of the series to a degree. Like OKC is very good at what they do defensively. We've seen that as far as their ability to force turnovers and force stops. When it comes to the Spurs, can they replicate the defense on the road again? And they'll have, in theory, two opportunities to do it. So can you have that level of physicality on the road? Can you get those kind of stops? Can you put pressure on Oklahoma City offensively in their building? That's where the game five becomes pivotal. For San Antonio specifically. Like, obviously, the balance of the series is going to hang. Someone's going to win, have a chance to win it. But I think for San Antonio, you got to swing for the fences for this one so you do not have to take a second trip to Oklahoma City. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? You got to go for it. And so what are they going to be able to do with Wimby, with their offense? Because I think that's the one thing that we can both agree is missing with San Antonio. They don't have the home run offensively yet. It's not that they're bad offensively, but they don't have that this is, you know, fastball down the middle, rising rise ball. I've been watching a lot of baseball, softball, don't worry about it. But we don't have that pitch that's gonna swing and miss. So we kind of have to figure this out and patchwork it to a degree where we do really good things over the course of 48 minutes. Oklahoma City does have that fastball. And we've seen them find it against San Antonio. So does that alter the math at all in the guys?
Mm-hmm. I think that's fair. Like, to that point, Steve, the Spurs get that win. The Spurs had an 80 offensive rating in the half court in game four. Like, this was not, to your point, this was not we just found a bunch of answers. We're just poking at defense. Now, the one thing that I will say about this, with San Antonio defending the way that they did, and obviously OKC was naturally missing people, so the rotation was going to look a little different anyway. OKC kind of having to lean more into, okay, let's trend really small. Let's get Isaiah Joe and Jarrett McCain on the floor, et cetera. Like, we have to play more of our spacier options to try to find ways to open things up. That does, in theory, make it a little bit easier for the Spurs in the half court. Like, okay, cool. Like, driving against Lu Dort is just a different experience than driving against Isaiah Joe or driving against Jarrett McCain or even driving against Aaron Wiggins. Welcome back to the rotation. And so for OKC, you also have to find some answers offensively with your core group, just so you are not forced into playing as small as you were at times in that game four. You want that to be more of a bonus. You want that to be more of a wave. If you are stuck playing offensively slanted lineups, because that's the only way you can generate good offense with how San Antonio's defending you now, San Antonio's like, okay, cool. We may not have like a pet action. Dylan Harper could just win a drive against this dude. Stephon Castle could just win a drive against this dude. And then it becomes a different fight. And it's like, okay, it doesn't matter if it's, let's say, a 93 offensive rating in the half over the Spurs. That is just better than what it was. And now that is enough for us to maybe win game five. And as you've talked about, the conference finals are a different deal. Like, we just have to find an answer to this. It doesn't have to be perfect. It doesn't have to be league best. It's just got to be good enough for us to win. And so that would be my middle of brain concern, I would say, with OKC. It's like, we got to find answers because we want to play better. But we also want to find answers so San Antonio doesn't breathe a little bit easier and find more things offensively moving forward.
How important is Chet in that process for Oklahoma City? Is the question that's in the back of my brain based on what you just said. What do they need him to do offensively in this series? I think the defense speaks for itself. We can agree on that. But offensively, what do you think Chet Holmgren has to do to add to what Oklahoma City is trying to get done in this Western Conference Finals?
I'm not going to do the bit. In all seriousness, I think it just starts with a baseline level of aggression for Chet. I would just like to see him on a very basic level. Like, you have to shoot the basketball, I think, is kind of where we start with Chet Holmgren. Beyond that, like, are there some cross screens they can get to get him some touches around the elbow so he can just simply rise up for jumpers, or he's a dribble away from the paint? Can you move Wimby around to where you can make those driving lanes a little bit more fruitful for him? Like, I think there are some things that you can do to scheme up some looks. But there are also just some possessions where you have Shea in the middle of the floor driving, or someone else puncturing the paint a little bit, and Chet is looking to pump and drive. It's like, okay, it can't always be that. Like, we do just kind of need some volume from somewhere, and you are a good shooter. And so, like, some of this is just him, like, you just have to let it fly to a certain degree. And then from there, again, can we get him some cross screens, get him some catches on the move, make it a little bit easier for him offensively? I do think he is going to be important for this, especially when you get into some of the non-Shea lineups, especially if Jalen Williams is out again. He's listed as questionable heading into the game five, but he was listed as questionable, I think, heading into game four, and he was ruled out. So we'll see. But yeah, the non-Shea minutes in particular, you just kind of need Chet to be willing to let it fly, so it's not just the guards that have to dribble around and create stuff.
It's funny you mentioned the non-Shea minutes, because San Antonio has to deal with the non-Victor Wembanyama minutes. And we saw prayer in game four. So we'll see if Luke Kornet's able to find different things going on throughout the series. But it's like, when you get to the end of a series, you're trying to find what are the battlegrounds, what is going to end a team depending on what happens. And so in my head, it's like, okay, does Chet deliver something the Spurs are not able to handle or deal with? And if you're San Antonio, okay, De'Aaron Fox is back. He's played well. We haven't seen the max of De'Aaron Fox, where he can kind of take and make these shots, make these drives that make things uncomfortable. Dylan Harper feels pretty good throughout. So it's like, are the Spurs a Fox or Vassell game away from flipping this right back on the Thunder and putting them in a pressure situation they didn't think they would be in the conference final? But that's the dynamic. I think if you're the Thunder, you know what you can do defensively. You know how Shea Gilgeous-Alexander's play affects the Spurs defense. Can you get back to the blend? And that's why I love this series. Like, I sit there, I watch it. They go to timeout. I'm looking up above. I'm smiling and I'm happy. This is what basketball is. The Spurs in Oklahoma City swinging for the fences is what this is supposed to be. We don't always get this in the conference finals, the guys, but they're delivering it. So, like, every time it feels like, I know what both these teams can do. What are they going to do? Oh, boy. Like, Victor Wembanyama made a half-court shot casually. Like, what's this guy doing? Like, what is he?
Yeah, it's insane. Like, we got the Stephon Castle dunk in game three, and then we got the Wimby shot in game four. It's like, what is happening right now? This is a lot. Quick shout outs for me before we move to the next section here. Okay. You already mentioned them. Again, welcome back, De'Aaron Fox. Nobody happier that De'Aaron Fox is back to Stephon Castle. He's like, oh, I don't have to run the offense. Fire. I can just attack in transition, attack on the second side, and I have more energy to just absolutely hound Shea Gilgeous-Alexander no matter where he is. His defense in game four was incredibly good on and off the ball. And I think having that added injury / less responsibility offensively helped him on that front. And then finally, Steve, as you know, you've been doing the podcast before a very long time, so you know this. Long-term dunkers know this. If you're new to the show, I am such a big fan of Devin Vassell as a basketball player, and have been before the Spurs got back to being, like, really good this year. And so for these last two games, for Vassell to still have the timely shot making, we talked a little bit about Chet, Vassell getting the Chet assignment early in games, and then also being asked to defend Shea at times. His defense has been superb, really, throughout this postseason run, but especially over the last two games. You drive against Devin Vassell, about 0.8 points per possession on those trips. That's not going to get it done. You run a pick and roll with Devin Vassell defending the ball handler, 0.77 points per possession on those trips. That's also not going to get it done. You run him off ball screens. He's been sticky there. You have him defending dribble handoffs, not high volume, but again, sticky with the navigation, getting back in front. And so when you have him taking on those assignments, like, you kind of bake in Stephon Castle, who did not make all defense this year, which, but either way, you got to bake in him being an insane defender. Devin Vassell also defending at this level, and then sprinkling in the transition threes, sprinkling in the random pull-ups. You've talked a lot, Steve, about his use as a screener for Victor Wembanyama on and off the ball. he has just been so important on both ends of the floor for the Spurs, in particular these last two games. I just wanted to make sure he got something in this segment because of how important he is. And we will see if he is able to maintain that as we get into game five, game six. And we'll see if we get a game seven. But wanted to shout out Devin Vassell. Heck of a series it's been for him. We are going to take a break from here. And when we return, we shift to the W, Steve. We got to see what's going on with the New York Liberty. The Portland Fire looking interesting. The Seattle Storm, back-to-back blowout wins, also looking interesting. We're going to bounce around. Please stick with us. And we are back with the Dunker Spot as we shift to the WNBA. Another fun weekend of games. I am back home from Las Vegas. They had the banner raising, and then they once again lost the ceremonial game. So that is kind of hashtag tough. Maybe we'll sprinkle in some Aces thoughts a little bit later. But, Steve, something that's been stuck in my head since the Friday pod. You were talking about how congested the middle of the standings are, which makes sense since we are still very early into the season. Commissioner's Cup play starts next week, by the way, so we got to be repping up for that. But it's been very jumbled up in the middle. And so I was looking at some of these matchups, like I was excited for Fire Tempo and just different games that we got. It's like, man, this really is kind of hazy. Not that I didn't believe you, but it's just kind of funny to watch how the weekend played out and some of these last-minute finishes between some of these teams. Like Mercury Dream was a lot of fun. Mercury's trying to climb their way higher up in the standings and things like that. It's been a fascinating start in the middle. So I guess just on a broader sense, Steve, how did you soak in the weekend?
That's the key word you said is fascinating. It's been a really fascinating start to this WNBA season. It's always been a very competitive league every season. We always had teams that you didn't think were going to be that good that rise to the top early, when we've had teams that you thought were going to be really good that kind of have to figure it out. And we've seen that play out with more teams. I think everyone is building right now. Everyone has to figure things out to some degree, and teams have different identities. I think that's the biggest sticking point when you watch these teams night in, night out. They are presenting different matchups, and they're presenting different problems within those matchups. And so, like, you look at like teams like, we haven't had to deal with inverted pick and roll. We haven't had to deal with a team that's read and react. We haven't had to deal with a team that's purely trying to go to the post. Like, every team can poke at each other in a way. And I think, again, that speaks to the road records for some of these teams. Dream have not lost a game on the road, 2-0. Fever, 1-0 on the road. Aces, 4-0 on the road. How many games have they won at home, Nick, guys?
Well, Steve, they had the ring ceremony to open the season and they lost. And then they had the banner raising against the Sparks, in which Kelsey Plum lost her mind in that basketball game. And they lost that one, too. So we are still eagerly awaiting the first home win of the season for the Las Vegas Aces.
Right, right. The Lynx are 3-0 on the road. Golden State Valkyries, they got Valhalla. They're 2-1 at home. Guess where else? They're 2-1 on the road. The Dallas Wings, we've had a lot of criticisms. They're 3-1 outside of Texas. And the Fire are 2-1, the Sky are 3-1. The Sparks have not lost a road game. So I think it speaks to just what this league is right now. Is like, you need to come correct and figure out what you got to handle. Because if not, this other team is going to win a game. And so the Dream being 4-1, the Fever being up there, the Lynx, the Valkyries, the Wings, the Fire being 4-3. Like, there's a lot of different teams that are kind of putting themselves in different positions that you may have imagined. I don't know who your top five would have been Nikias preseason, start of season. Last week, I think it's pretty hard to imagine and picture a world where you did not have the Mercury and Liberty in that top five. So Mercury are 2-5. The New York Liberty are 3-4. And it's a consistent reminder that whatever success you find in the W, it is going to be chased in this league, and it's going to be potentially hunted down. And I think it's very fascinating, right? As we get to this inflection point where it feels like deja vu to a degree. If you go back to last year, Nikias, do you remember when the Liberty were 17-6 and then they ended up being 21-13 like a week and a half later? And it's like, hey, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. And I feel like we've reached a point with the New York Liberty where people are asking, hey, what's going on here? And the fascinating part is these two teams face each other on Wednesday and Friday in a, hey, neither of us were supposed to be here type scenario. And this this is a tough series for either one of these teams because someone's going to go hurt. Like we've seen the Mercury, when they lock in, the Mercury we saw against the Aces, and we'll talk about it later probably, we haven't seen that Mercury since then to a degree. The Liberty haven't necessarily knocked on the door. And let's talk about the New York Liberty, right? We're here.
Okay.
We're here.
Let's go, guys. Liberty.
The New York Liberty have lost to the Portland Fire twice this season. Season series over. They've lost to the Golden State Valkyries. They lost to the Dallas Wings. The New York Liberty, as of recording, have lost three straight games. The New York Liberty have lost three straight games in the Barclays Center at home in front of Ellie the Elephant. And so this is where the tricky part comes in. Because I think this stretch for them, obviously, like, this is their season-long homestand for the year. You need to win those games. But this was, as we talked before the weekend started, a little bit of a get-right opportunity for them. Not because of who they were playing, but, hey, you have the chance to finally get Satu Sabli back. You have the chance to finally get Sabrina Ionescu back. Let's see what we have to agree. What do we have, Nikias? I'm not certain at this point. The first four games of the season, the New York Liberty scored 106 points, 98 points, 96 points, 100 points. That's the graphic that people held on to. And so when you look at the New York Liberty, you look at the talent they have, they add Satu Sabli, they're going to be up here for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Last three games, these three losses, 70 points against Golden State, 76 points against Dallas, 74 points against the Portland Fire. If you look at the last 12 quarters of New York Liberty basketball that they have played in, they have scored 20 points or less in eight of the last 12 quarters they've played.
Ooh.
If you look at the last three games from the three-point line against Golden State, there were 6 of 24. No one made more than one for the Liberty. Yep. That's the six came from six different people. They were 8 of 26 against Dallas. Seven of those came from Satu Sabli, Sabrina Ionescu, and Hanzu. And they were 8 of 24 against Portland. And five of those eight made threes came from Marin Yohannes. Three games, 22 of 74 from three, 29.7%. And so you get to the end of this three-game stretch. Satu, hopes she's well, is able to play four minutes against Portland. Sabrina sat that one out. The availability portion of the program is not an excuse. It is something to think about and ponder because we have not seen them at full force. I think, to be honest, and I hope Benaja Laney Hamilton is okay, but I think that's the most important thing. Her being out changed a whole lot of the math when it came to lineups and whatnot. They're still working to get Leona Hewish back. Those are two of the more significant dominoes in the star-studded lineup to glue everything together for the Liberty have to address on offense and defense. So they have help on the way. So, yes, the people have been out is not the overall excuse, but there's a different Liberty team that's on the way. So how do we navigate that, Nikias? And I think it's an interesting dynamic as far as the Liberty have been what they are, grew into something different, and now are trying to evolve. Think about this, right? In 2024, they were first in offensive rating, third in defensive rating. Probably the peak of the Liberty farm, right? Considering what happened that year?
Won a title. And knocked out the defending champs on the way there.
So that's the vision, right? Last year, they were fifth in offensive rating, sixth in defensive rating. Not bad, but where are we going? And are we going the right way on either end of the floor? This year, if you look it up, small sample, I understand, the Liberty are seventh in offensive rating. They're eighth in defensive rating. Can that be the bit? Which portion of the program are you hitting? What are you nailing with this team? Because now this is the danger. Like, we always talk about the teams that, they're on the rise. They just need a different voice. Things go in this direction. Poof, they're gone. What happens when a team has actually won a championship? They have the equity of having won a championship. They add more talent to a champion team, and now the vision's a little bit different. What are the Liberty good at? What do they do that nails things every single night? What can you count on? Did you poke at your identity to a degree? When the New York Liberty get stops, they can run. And again, they have not had Benaja. They have not had Lenny Fibich. That alters a lot of lineups. But how many lineups have been geared towards playing defense? You've got some pretty high-powered offensive lineups as far as your guard play, right? Rene Yohannes, very good. Pauline Astier has been very good. And the problem is, if you're not getting stops and you're not executing a high level offensively, what happens? Are there enough of the moments where the Liberty are getting into their actions quick enough? Or are the moments happening where they're getting to their first action with 18 or 16 on the clock? And okay, who's rolling? Who's spaced? Who's on the second side? What are you trying to poke at? Are you being intentional with those moments where you're a little bit slower? If it's, what are the Jonquel post-ups look like? What are the Stewie post-ups look like? Satu cross-matching and transition has been fruitful for you, but what do the Satu touches look like? Are you, is it just Satu spaced, makes threes, gets a post-up, gets a small and transition? How much have the versatility have you gotten to with the dribble handoffs, the drives? Like, are you putting pressure on teams in the same way? And so this is a team that's going to eventually have to figure out how to deal with switching to a degree, right? Like, if if I have to deal with Sabrina, Satu, Jonquel, et cetera, we're going to switch and like try and figure it out. Okay. What type of shots are the Liberty generating right now? Are these shots of what they want to? Dimensional three-point percentage? Or are these a lot of let it fly shots? These a lot of talent shots? Is this because of what we're doing offensively or because of who we have on the court? I think there have been moments where they've been able to lean into Stewie and Jonquel, especially against the Wings in that fourth quarter, to where, okay, you have to deal with us. But like, the Liberty have always maxed out with having enough defense around the potential and the strength they bring offensively. They're living in a scenario right now where, ooh, we don't really have this offensively, and ooh, we don't really have this defensively. And that's a different type of scenario for them. So you got a lot of offense first lineups. You get hurt by driving kick. You got dribble penetration and teams letting it fly. Dallas, every stop they got, it's like, huh, push, kick, three, got you. Now you're facing a different game. Portland got back in that game because, stops, cool, read and react. You don't know what we're going to do. We're going to find the shots we want. So that's where it's like, what is the best thing that the New York Liberty do right now? What is it, Nikias?
No, I think that's a fair question to ask. And I think to go back to the very beginning, just like, what are the New York Liberty and how do you absorb the New York Liberty right now? For me, I have been in a pretty big holding pattern for them just because, as you alluded to already, no Lenny Fibich, no Bena Delaney Hamilton. And then early on, they didn't have Satu, and then they didn't have Sabrina Ionescu either. So like, that is just four of your top six out for either the entire stretch or for most of the stretch. And it's like, well, one, they're very good, so that obviously alters what you want to do. But then you talk about the specific importance for the defensive concerns that I have about the Liberty. Like, hey, what are your off-ball switches looking like? What does the help look like? How tidy are you off the ball with your rotations and things? You may not have to answer as many of those if Bena Delaney Hamilton or Lenny Fibich is navigating screens for you. Or they're just turning this stuff into late switches, and like, you're just not in rotation when those two are in. So I'm like, I'm trying to balance. I'm watching the games, like, this doesn't feel great, but like, how much of this is a long-term problem? I don't know yet, because I would like to see them back into the fold. To the offense, and like, I was looking up some numbers before the pod just to see, this has certainly felt different for the Liberty. Again, they're missing folks, but like, what exactly is different with this Liberty group so far? And so just looking at it per second spectrum, last year, the Liberty were a little bit under 350 passes per 100 possessions at 347.7, down to 320 per 100 so far this year. So not passing as often, or that at as high of a rate as they were last year. In terms of pick and rolls last year, about 77 per 100 possessions. That's down to 65 this year. In terms of what percentage of those pick and rolls are in like the traditional five out alignment, we heard a lot about that heading into the season with Sandy Brondello. About 43% of their pick and rolls, that has dropped to 33%, which is something that I want to investigate a little bit more, because it feels like they will set up in that, and then you just have so much of the cutting and like the corner to corner relocations and things like that. So I wonder how much of that plays into the number being lower, but it is lower. They are posting up slightly more than they did last year. They are driving the basketball more than they did last year. But to your point, Steve, how much of those drives are because we tried to run something and we didn't get to what we wanted to, and now we have to win our 1v1 versus we have put you in rotation and now we are attacking your scrambling defense? Like, it's felt more of the former to me, or at least in the former, it's been more of that than I would like, if that makes sense.
No, it does. And I just want to say, it feels like they're relying more on the fact that the talent will force that on top of the flow. And you end up in a position where the flow is not there. Mm-hmm. You're not winning matchups to a degree at certain times. And like Jonquel Jones and Stewie are an incredible duo. And we've seen them prove that time and time again. But on the nights where they're not automatically winning some of these, it gets tricky because you don't have them as anchors. And so you end up where you have these possessions with like, where are we trying to attack? Like against Dallas, there was a possession where it was like, I love some big, big action, right? But it was Stewie and Jonquel operating on one side. Dallas was going to switch that. And they advanced the ball. And it was Rebecca Gardner screening for Pauline Assier. And Dallas was like, we're going to switch that. And so they swung it back to another Stewie Jonquel big and roll. And Dallas was like, well, we're going to switch that. So, like, if you're going to have the pressure points, you got to be intentional about poking at which ones you're trying to get to. And then you have to be decisive. I think that's the part that's been missing from this Liberty team, right? Early in that Portland game, let's go Satu Marine pick and roll. Takes like 7 seconds to load that up. You don't get the response from the Fire defense you want. You skip to Jonquel, and now Jonquel has a drive from the perimeter to a post up to try and get a shot. Those are the possessions where it's like, okay, can we clean that up and take our talent and now have some more pressure points to where, okay, we're going to make you decide how you want to deal with us as opposed to relying on our talent to win or make specific shots to make this untenable. That's, I feel like the dynamic of this specific New York Liberty team. And so you got pick and roll play. Marine Yohannes is a pick and roll wizard. How great have you felt about some of those moments? And is the defense reacting? Because if it's just going to be Marine that gets dropped, you're not going to get the passing. Marine's going to make shots to get defense to adjust. It is what it is. So can you poke some of those buttons? I think against Dallas, they found fourth quarter, they're facing an uphill battle, but they found enough moments where it's like, okay, we can kind of poke and find different ways to get Jonquel and Stewie post touches to make Dallas react and kind of make them operate in a different way. So the talent's there. It's just, what are you building? What are you putting together? How are you getting it together? Mm-hmm. And we don't have the answers yet because we haven't seen everyone play together.
Yeah.
And so again, it's the familiar portion of, well, if they can figure this out, when everyone's out, they'll be better off for it. This is a learning repetition for Liberty. The problem is in this league. Last year, and I said it last year, the problem with their fall last year is it took their path into a different direction. Now you have to deal with a Mercury team because you've done with enough games. But look at this season. Right now you're out. So you better start making push real quick. Like, I know the gap isn't huge, but like, you don't want to be lower seed in this W right now. So like, you got to get it together to a degree where you start to feel confident again. I think part of it is lineup construction. That's why I poke at I knock on the Benaja and the only Fuge being out portion, because you don't have some of the defensive lineups you can throw out there where, hey, guess what? You're not scoring. We're flowing. And we can do some of these offensive concepts, but you're not scoring. So as they get back to more of that, could it just be easier? And then they can hone in on the half court? Absolutely. Like, I think they have too much talent to not put pressure on defenses. They just have to be able to find a way to get stops. And then keep pressure on offenses. I mean, get stops and keep pressure on defenses in a way that's sustainable for them. That's the missing journey. And I think the biggest piece is like, they were 3-1 when Benaja played. A lot of losses have been since Benaja's been out of line. Like, they are glue pieces here to make all of this fit together. And I think if you live in a world where you get Benaja, Leonie Fibish, and Rebecca Allen playing a certain level, with the lineup combinations you can get, with the guard play you've seen grow throughout the early portion of the season, a lot on the table for Liberty. They do just have to know and be aware they have to get there. And they're in a tough scenario because, again, homestand, they haven't played a home road game since May 14th. They won't play another one until June the 8th. You need to flip this homestand and win these next four games. Unfortunately, you're facing a Phoenix Mercury team that has also been in their certain level of hell. You're facing a Toronto Tipper team that you never know what they're going to do. And then you have the Indiana Fever. So this is the time is now for the Liberty. because you didn't win any of the first three, you got to win these four or else you're in danger.
It gets funny. And so, like, I'm right there with you. And this is why I appreciate how we talk about this, where it's like, yes, let's talk about what we've seen, but also understand there may be a wave coming here. So let's just track the progress type thing. So this should not be the Liberty are doomed. Like, that is not the tenure of the conversation. That shouldn't be the takeaway from this conversation. But it's like, hey, these are some things that you have to clean up. What's been fascinating me, Steve, because we've been talking a lot about the Liberty offense, and understandably so, there are just some structural, some flow things that just have to be worked out and should get better once they get healthier. It's also been interesting seeing how teams have tried to treat them this year. And like, I've seen your tweets about them. I think Lucas Kaplan has been someone that's been on it early about like what the Liberty look like against ball pressure in particular. And so like looking at how often they see two on the ball, just that's pure double teams, that's helping the drive, et cetera. It was about 8% of their touches last year. That's up to 10.2% this year. In terms of how often they are getting picked up in the backcourt. So you're talking about some of the full court pressure and things like that. It was around 13.7% last year. That is up to 20.5% this year. And I wonder how much of that is y'all don't have Sabrina right now, so let's test out these young ball handlers. How much of that is we have played the Portland Fire multiple times already this year, and they are a team that just wants to do that. So like that could just skew the numbers on top of that. And I wonder how much of this is just when we think about the New York Liberty, because of the talent, because of the size and things that we can get into, is our best pathway to disrupting them overall, whether they're healthy or not, is it to just muck things up and work them deeper in the clock and then lean into the switching, which interestingly enough, switch rate that they've seen so far is slightly lower than last year, but it's still pretty high compared to the rest of the league. So I'm keeping an eye on that. And they are seeing two on the ball more in pick and roll than they were last year. But again, we're dealing with a 7-game sample right now. So we'll see how that normalizes. But I'm fascinated by teams saying, let's ramp this up against the Liberty. Let's pick them up higher. Let's be physical. We still have a level of switching. And I think that all exacerbates what you were talking about, Steve, was like, okay, what exactly are we setting up to begin with? If we got both our bigs on the same side, okay, we can lean into the switching here, and it's taking you longer to even get to that piece because we are pressuring you up the floor. And if you are trying to get into the fun off-ball stuff, we're being physical with you and we're jamming you and we're making you work hard on that. I think that's part of why we've seen the post-ups uptick so far this year, where it's just like, okay, well, we have finally gotten a switch. We can't get into some of the other, maybe the two or three player actually we want to get into on the second side. Let's just give the ball to Stewie at the free throw line. Let's just give the ball to John Quayle at the free throw line and just let them go. And because they're so good, they can still win some of those trips. But in terms of their overall flow, it's like, that's not the Liberty team that I thought we were going to get. So I am fascinated to see like how they are able to kind of dig their way out of this. Because to your point, like 3-4, you know, 7 games out of 44, like that's, it's a small sample. Like they should be okay as they get healthier. But if this 3-4 start leads to us getting to like late August, early September, and it's like, oh, the Liberty need to go 4-0 to go from the 5 seed to the 3 seed, then we're going to be looking back at this stretch like, maybe if you were better on that opening homestand, you're not in this position to where you're starting a playoff series on the road or something like that. So like these games still matter. But I'm fascinated by like the ball pressure in particular, because like Marine's getting hounded a little bit. Pauline Astier's getting hounded a little bit. Now to the Pauline portion, she has been able to win a lot of those drives anyway, because she has just been fantastic as a downhill threat to start the year. But it's like, huh, I didn't anticipate teams ramping it up to this degree. Like you saw it in the Valkyries game in particular. Like it felt like anytime, the amount of times that Breanna Stewart was catching the ball like 32 feet from the basket to flow into like a handoff or something to the second side. I was like, that doesn't feel like something we've seen consistently before. And I wonder how much of that formula is going to continue as the season goes on. But it's been weird. I guess for that, how have you felt about how defenses have tried to treat the Liberty? That's the question I toss to you.
As far as like how they want to like help and double, like I think it's very clear there are moments they want to take Stewie and John Quill away. I think it's very clear they're telling, like saying the guards have to produce a certain level. This changes once the talent level changes. And that's why I think it's important for New York to be intentional with who they put in action to force the defense to react so they can play out of it. And so that's where I want to see them grow as the season goes on. I think defensively, as they get their personal back, they'll be better on that end. They will be able to flow and get some easier baskets. And so it's not that the Liberty are done. It's more they're in a position where they got to figure it out very quickly. And they're going to face a team that is also trying to figure it out very quickly in the Phoenix Mercury. So that's a fascinating matchup to watch over the course of these days. Tune into your TVs to watch the Mercury Liberty have a 2-game series. Now, very quickly, I want to talk about the Portland Fire.
Ah, yes.
Talk about what the Portland Fire has produced. Won 3 of their last 4 games, 2 of their last 3 on the road. And I think it's very fascinating to watch this Fire team piece everything together, because they're not an easy team to deal with. Like if you saw the Valkyries last year and you knew they were going to defend, I think the Fire are the offensive version of that as an expansion team. because they have that CLA, that constraints-led approach, to where we're not going to go one-on-one. We're going to put our players in different scenarios in practice. We're going to try and emphasize different situations and put them in different ideals to where they perform differently in practice, and that will lead to production in the games. They're a hard team to deal with because of the fact that you don't necessarily know what they're going to do. They have the whole idea is that they are going to have the reads and the ideas and the concepts to counter whatever you want to do defensively. Now, it's not a perfect world. They're going to have to build this out because teams have found ways to kind of put them in a box to a degree. But that's not stopped their attempts. And I think that's the important part to watch. They have the identity and they lean on the identity and they continue to play through it because, okay, we may go with a pistol type action, but that's something that we know. We may swing it. Now that's a flare. We know where our cuts are coming from. You don't necessarily know. I think it's going to be interesting to see how that looks like as more tape builds throughout the season, but if they can have success early as they get more comfortable with it. And I think that's the thing where you see them play Toronto, you see them play New York, you see them have rough patches. But boy, when they get it going, they figure it out. It's hard to deal with because there's not one specific thing they're trying to do. They're reading what you do. They're playing out of it. And they have a lot of skilled and talented players throughout the lineup. And so I think when you look at the contributions of Sarah Ashley Barker, who has just summoned the spirit of Jackie Stiles and said, I'm going to get buckets in Portland, that's no problem. Bridget Carlton, a great fit. As far as we don't need you to make every single play, be the best version of yourself and you'll have opportunities to continue to grow. We have skilled bigs. We have the ability to have spacing and cutting and playmaking and do this continuously. And I think when you look at the ability to kind of have a Carla Late who, you know what, I'd like to go get a bucket. The sequence she had against the Liberty where it's like, yeah, I'm going to go one-on-one, get a layup. Hey, you forced and put Stewie on me, bop, 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 one-on-one, big-time jump shot. Like, that's not common things, but this is what they've kind of built to a degree. So I'm intrigued to see how you feel about the Fire, because I know you are a fan of the process. And the Fire are a lot about the process. So where are you at with the Portland Fire, Nikaias?
Brother, my brother, I'm glad you said this. I have had so much fun watching this Portland Fire group. And like, not only have I had fun watching this Fire group, I've had fun like listening to Alex Aroma talk about these different concepts, like post-practice interviews and things like that. It's like, it just speaks to my basketball brain where you're talking about, to your point, the process of things and like how we're trying to build this out. It's like, you know what? Regardless of if it actually works or not, they are 4-3 right now. So like, obviously they're not undefeated. But like, I love that there is a plan. I love that there is rationale behind what they're trying to build. And then you get to what they're doing on the court. And it's like, okay, these concepts make sense for the talent that they have. And then it's also fun to kind of envision, hey, if they put together a strong enough season, whether that's playoffs or they're like 3 games out or whatever the case may be, if the concepts look strong enough on both ends of the floor, what does this look like if they are able to entice a borderline all-star, an actual all-star, a legitimate star? Like, what does that look like within the principles that they are working to establish now? So, like, conceptually, I'm just kind of in with the Fire. Now, as to what their recent games have looked like, even going back to that Liberty game, things like that, you get to see all of that on display. And, like, how they are setting up their offense to make life easier for, like, Carla Late in particular, for Bridget Carlton, the way that they move them around the board, the way that they space around those players to make their decision-making tree a little bit easier. Like, it's smart stuff, and they are taking full advantage. Like, I think Carla Late, you saw it in Golden State in her minutes. She is someone that can just get downhill pretty much whenever she wants to. Has to finish the job when she gets there, but she can get downhill whenever she wants to. And so the Fire being intentional about, all right, cool, we're going to spam either a bunch of empty side actions with her, or let's flatten the floor, get her at the top of the key. Let's see, let's set a flatter screen if it's a guard, or let's just get a big involved. Can you beat Carla Late to her spot within this spacing setup, knowing that you don't have anybody on the wing to kind of swipe at her drive? You probably don't unless you have an elite defender. And which means she just gets to lead the dance. Their defense, their 12th in defensive rating as of recording. But as you know, Steve, I've been getting a good chuckle out of, hey, let's just go full court pressure. Let's sprinkle in these traps, et cetera. When they are able to get stops, that just means Carla Late just gets to run free and transition now. And you have to stop that speed demon from getting downhill. And they have a bunch of smart spacers around that. They can fill corners, fill wings. We can get to catch and shoot threes from there. And so, like, there's just a wave that they can hit you with when their defense hits for certain stretches. to where like, oh snap, we are now down 8. We didn't expect to be here. This is an uphill climb. And when we come out of this timeout, they're probably going to pressure us again. And there's a level of problem solving that they force you to do within these games that even if you end up winning, you got to work pretty hard to get there. So like, I have some stats a little bit later, but just foundationally, I like what they are putting together and what they are establishing right now.
Well, I think it'll be a theme throughout the rest of this pod, but this is a team that's empowered. And so you've seen all of their players play and have different moments to where Megan Gustafson has come in, maybe played 15, 18 minutes. You look up, she's had 11, 12 points, maybe one rebound, but she's been effective because she knows her role, right? Oblak came and decided, you know what? We need a real point guard. I'm going to get down the hill. I'm going to throw the ball over. We're going to play out of it. Emily Engstler is a versatile skill piece that we have seen. I wonder what this looks like in different places. Fully unlocked to a degree in Portland. Luisa is now just, you know what? I'm open from three. Maybe I went 2 for 9 from the field. Both of those were threes. I'm just going to let it fly. So like, there's a confidence that Portland plays with offensively. I think the biggest question is probably the defense for them. Can they get a consistent effort to step up to maximize what they built offensively is the question for the Portland Fire. If they can do that, they put themselves in position to kind of have that Golden State Valkyrie effect of, you didn't necessarily understand what we were trying to do. Now you have to deal with us. Now, I will say, Mekhi's Duncan. Mm-hmm. This is a very important stretch for the Portland Fire because I don't know if you've seen their schedule.
Oh, it gets fun.
They got 3 games at home. They play Connecticut. Then they play the Atlanta Dream. They play the Indiana Fever. That's a back-to-back. Then they go to Valhalla and play the Valkyries. They play the Mercury. They play at the Sparks. Then they play the Aces and the Wings at home. That chunk feels like we're going to have some answers about the Portland Fire as far as, okay, are we tapping the ceiling with our head or is there room above us?
No, I think that part is fun. As you were talking about the empowerment, Steve, can I give you one of my early favorite stats about the Portland Fire on the player side?
Good.
So as of recording, Megan Gustafson has already logged 10 post-up touches this year. You know how many she had combined over the last 2 seasons?
8.
7.
Very close.
I know that's going to burn you up. 7 across the last 2 seasons. Again, the Aces largely asked her, hey, please be a spacer for us, screen in space. We want you to get the 3-point volume up. And so the fact that she's mixing in the 3-point volume and also, hey, Meg, we're going to dump this down to you. It's like 1.7 points per possession on those trips, which again is 10, so the sample is super small. But it's a nice reminder that like, hey, she kind of came into the league as like a post bucket with like hopes of stretching the game out. And it kind of got inverted during Vegas. And now we're just kind of back to Meg, do what you do within our principles. And then you also have the freedom to do that. So that part's been fun. Now, to the overall portion with the Portland Fire, something that I pointed out early on, Steve, with the Fire was just their spacing principles in general and kind of looking at what they were doing in pick and roll. And so early on this season, Steve, no team in the W is running pick and roll at a higher rate than the Portland Fire right now. Nearly 93 picks per 100 possessions per second spectrum. They're at 0.95 points per possession on those trips to start the year. That is third in the W. I've talked about this a good bit with like the Washington Mystics and how low they're setting their screens, but like the Portland Fire as a recording currently have the lowest average distance with their pick and roll so far this year, 22.5 feet. So like right around the 3-point line. And so when you pair that with how they're spacing, having someone in the dunker spot, which to that point, over 21% of their pick and rolls involve someone in the dunker spot. That's the second highest rate in the league behind the Las Vegas Aces. And then they also mix in like the empty corner, empty side stuff as well. Like they just do such a good job of putting immediate stress on your defense. It's like, we're going to run these low. We're going to flatten the floor or it's going to empty a side. You have to decide if you want to help or not. And as we talked about in preseason, they also layer that with random cutting from the wing. We'll set these random flares up top. We'll set some pin-in screens from the corner. So if we are driving baseline, we have immediate kickouts. So we can keep the train rolling. Like they just do such a good job of, again, conceptually making it tough for your defense. And so I'm curious to see where the efficiency normalizes as the sample grows. Because again, we are going to get more tape and you just laid out what the upcoming schedule is. There are a lot of good defenses and good defenders within those groups of games. So like this is going to get fascinating. But that part has been fun. And I just want to put on notice here, Carla Late having herself one heck of a season. Steve, you already talked about some of the late shot making that we saw against the New York Liberty on Monday night. But if we're talking about an early most improved player case, the scoring has more than doubled. The assists have more than doubled. More efficient inside the arc despite the tips going up. She's been one of the best drivers in basketball. The pick and roll efficiency has certainly skyrocketed so far this year. She is thriving with this freedom. in the spacing that they have afforded her. And so, again, as the tape grows, as the sample grows, we'll see where things normalize. But I just wanted to quickly salute the season that Carla Lade is having. Like, she's at 16-4 right now. I think over a steal per game as well. So getting after it a little bit defensively, there are some things you could poke at with screen navigation. But she's had herself one heck of a year. You already talked about Sarah Ashley Barker. I talked about her a little bit on Friday. I've enjoyed the Emily Inksler experience so far this year. Like, I have enjoyed watching the Portland Fire play basketball, to go back to your early question, Steve. It's been a lot of fun.
Finally, Nekias enjoys something out of Portland. Very interesting that Carla Lade is going to be the one that breaks your year two rule with most improved, but we'll talk about that later. I want to keep it in the Pacific Northwest, and I want to talk about the Seattle Storm and have we slept on version 2.0 of the Seattle Storm, because I was watching the Mystics game and I was thinking, you know what? Things have been building in a specific direction. This team that's obviously has won two in a row at home, beat Connecticut, beat Washington. But we talked about every guard or wing feeling empowered for the Storm team, right? Whether it was Natisha Hyde, Jordan Horston, Lexi Brown, Zaya Cook, whoever was able to have the ball in their hands, Jade Melbourne, they felt good about what they were doing offensively. You had Stephanie Dolson kind of keeping things together to a degree, but now we're starting to get into the part of the program where the demons are starting to knock on the door. Awafam is here. They will eventually have Awafam plus Dominique Malanga plus Ezzy Madbigor, who are all versatile and impactful on all of their ends. So in the future, it's like, okay, we're going to have those three plus guards who feel really good, plus a base of Stephanie Dolson, and Katie Lou Samuelson's back on the court. Like, hey, do we need to take a look at the Storm and not, like, do we have to appreciate how fun they are to where, okay, we have a flow offensively. All of our guards are going to look to attack and get downhill. Defensively, we may not be the best team in the world, but did you know where they are at in defensive rating? Not according to Clean the Glass, they're sixth. So you're telling me the Storm are going to get after a little bit defensively? They're going to go ahead and push it on the other end? Like, this feels like reverse fire to a degree, to where, hey, we have a ceiling you have not seen yet. And so if we're going to be able to take what we've done with every single guard and wing in our program to play with confidence, and we have three extremely versatile players that we can place in different places on each end of the floor. Like, if I told you they played Dom, Awa, or Ezzy as a three, let alone if they played those three together, would you be surprised?
No, not really.
That's where the Storm become very, very interesting to me early in this season for the W. So I just wanted to give a tip of the cap to them. And shout out to Large Mother.
No shot are we rocking with that. To center this conversation back, I have enjoyed watching the Seattle Storm. So big blowout wins. Hey, Steve, you know what their net rating is right now after their big back
what you got?
Zero. They have gone from negative to just neutral right now. I was joking over the weekend. I was like, hey, as they're just beating the brakes off of the Mystics, I was like, all right, are they about to be like fifth in net rating all of a sudden because of how these last couple of games have gone? So not quite there yet, but they are neutral right now. But to your overall point, the guard empowerment has been loud. Like, we are not far removed from what, the 25-point game for Zaya Cook, where it's just like, man, if she becomes a better finisher, like – I don't want to go hyperbolic with like the sky's the limit, but the finishing perks up, like, she can create a shot from the perimeter whenever she wants to. I was talking about her uptick in defensive effort and, you know, the off-ball attention last year, and that is largely carried over so far this year. She has earned her way into the rotation. She is playing with a level of freedom on both ends of the floor and just like, shoulders are down, let me just play some basketball, that we just have not gotten to see consistently in her W career. So like, just as a basketball fan, it's cool to see a young player just feel at home somewhere. And she's flourishing at this point. We talked during the preseason about how Seattle was being intentional about setting up the Flage touches with off-ball movement, off-ball screens, and things like that. I've been pleasantly surprised with how often they've just let her run pick and roll and just kind of seeing some of her reads out of there. She's mixing in some pocket passes. She is still primarily looking to get the pull-ups or get the drives. So curious to see like how her process continues to grow as the season goes on. But like, that part's been fun. Jade Melbourne continues to drive all over the place. And there's just not much you can do with her when she gets a shoulder into you, you're just cooked. So that part's been fun for me. The Awafam debut, Steve. it was both fun and frustrating for me because it felt like for 80% of her minutes, she was just in the corner. I'm just like, hey, can we use her as a hub and unlock some of this passing? Can we use her as a screener, please, so she can slip into space and like make some reads, make some plays? But we eventually got there, and it's just 10 points in her debut. And it's like, well, we are now starting to see the fun stuff. Defensively, you see some of the activity when she's at the level. There was one rep very early on in the game where she was like, not quite at the level, but a step below it. She was fine. She dropped back. And then she came back up to like kind of swipe at the ball handler, and she opened up a roll. And I was like, hey, let's calm down a little bit. But after that rip, like, she was just firmly solid on that end. And I was like, you know what? If we get some activity-based stuff defensively and she's firm, she's going to run the floor and get some easy ones there. You have like the pick and roll stuff because of how quickly she slips out and how good her hands are and how she's able to find finishing windows. And then you have the passing hub stuff. I am excited for game two, game three, game five. I just want to see more Alphon. And to your overall point, Steve, you get all these bigs back. What are these lineup combinations going to look like? That's going to be fun for me. So yeah, you should keep eyes on the Seattle Storm for sure. Like, this is a fun young group.
Nakai, so you ever use a crock pot?
Yeah.
Just gotta let it cook.
Let it cook.
And so I think the biggest thing is like not overwhelming Alphon with, hey, you have to do X, Y, and Z. And like, I think the biggest thing to me that jumped out on the screen was like Alphon was willing to re-space and clear out and understand the Storm's concepts and then play out of it. And then they were able to use her as far as, let's get you a pin down. Got the pin down, wasn't there, spaced back out to perimeter. Let me make myself available, spin the ball, get back to pick and roll. I think the biggest thing you saw early on from Alphon was, hey, pick and roll, I can get contact, but I'm releasing to this roll or pop very quickly. And so my footwork is there, my positioning is there, and you have to deal with me in that way. And then defensively, there's just a juice and an activity that you see consistently where it's like, okay, maybe it's not a perfect world, but you're in a drop, you're willing to go, you're willing to engage, you're willing to release based on trusting your guard or wing to get back in front. That's going to pay off volumes, especially when you consider they have Ezzie Magbegore and Dominique Malanga who will be on the same team. So like, this is a thing where it's like, we don't have the full cake. We got a taste. Eyes are blinded to a degree. We got the hints of cinnamon. Things will get better going on.
What an unbelievable collection of words you just put together to close that out. Well done, Steve. Well done. So keep eyes on the Seattle Storm. Some quick shouts just before we get out of here, since we didn't talk about them in depth today. The Atlanta Dream, top of the standings. We see you. Another come from behind victory against the Phoenix Mercury. That defense remains absurd.
Committed to defense. Respect Angel Reese in the post.
Hey, listen, she is going to the free throw line. You are not going to have fun dealing with her down there. But what, two, maybe three all defense candidates already for the Atlanta Dream? We see you. Minnesota Lynx, I teased on Friday. We're going to be coming close to a segment. They may just be on Friday. They continue to win. Buddy, that offense is electric. I am enjoying watching the Minnesota Lynx play basketball. And so I wanted to get that in. And with the Phoenix Mercury, I do have my eyes on you. I think you're also going to be fine as you get healthier. Monika Koamakani on the way back. Let's get her in the lineup, please. They need that defense. But just know we see you towards the bottom of the standings there. We're gonna get into some Mercury talk soon as well. But thank you for listening to and or watching this episode of The Dunker Spot. Please subscribe if you haven't already. We are on Apple, Spotify, RIP Google, Stitcher, Podbean, wherever you get your podcast, you can find us. Subscribe to the Yahoo NBA YouTube channel. That's where the NBA playoff content is going. Subscribe to the Yahoo Sports main channel. That is where the WNBA content is going every Tuesday and Friday, just like the NBA stuff. You can follow me on socials at NakaiasNBA. You can follow Steve on socials at Steve Jones 20. And with that, we will catch y'all on Friday.